The following program is a PodcastOne.com production. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse, unscripted. Now, here's your host, John Horn.
I'm John Horn. Coming up next on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, Matt Walsh from Veep. He talks about his press secretary, Mike McClinic, how he compares to Sean Spicer, and some auditions that did not go very well.
This is Norman Lear with my great sidekick, Paul Hipp.
Good to be here with you, Norman, on All of the Above.
That's the name of my podcast, All of the Above. And it's called All of the Above because we're going to talk about all of the above. There isn't anything sacrosanct.
There's nothing too above us or below us.
Or below us. Well, certainly nothing too below us. But we have had guests you cannot believe.
Yeah.
Guests.
Julie Louis-Dreyfus. Amazing.
Yes. And America Ferrera.
Jared Carmichael.
Yes. Oh, Amy Poehler. How did we overlook? We didn't overlook Amy Poehler. I was saving her for last. And Charles Barkley, I was saving him for first, actually, because I didn't declare up first.
I get to hang out with this guy. And this is your chance to hang out with Norman Lear a little bit here and some of these great guests.
God, I wish I was you hanging out with Norman Lear.
Yeah.
Son of a gun. See? That must be exciting.
It's the best. Oh. I'm telling you.
Don't miss All of the Above with Norman Lear. Download new episodes every week on the Podcast One app or subscribe at PodcastOne.com. Now back to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Matt Walsh, welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Great to see you again.
Are you off book? Have you memorized your lines? Because we are unscripted.
I'm going to do monologues only. I'm no scene work. I can't work with partners.
You're going to go
all just me.
Sam Shepard, Chekhov, what are you going to do? What's
Sam
your monologue?
Shepard, Eugene O'Neill, some big ones from Eugene O'Neill, Arthur Miller, you know, maybe something comedic. I'm trying to think. Hart and what's her name? The two who wrote You Can't Take It With You?
Lorenz and Hart.
Is that it?
I don't know. Anyways. We'll be corrected. So you brought it upon yourself. Worst audition ever. Let's rewind the clock. It could be college, it could be out of college, it could be, you know, big part trying out and things go very south.
Well, two come to mind. One was my first agent in Chicago. It was just a commercial agent, but you had to rehearse something dramatic and something comedic. So I went in and I memorized the monologue that Tom Berenger gives from Platoon, but it was sort of, I thought it was comedic because he's a badass and I'm not a badass. So I just did the monologue and she's like, do you have anything comedic? And I'm like, that was sort of, that was it.
That was supposed to be comedic?
That was it. And then the other one was I had not done commercials. When I first got here, I was doing commercials and then I was fortunate enough to have a gig. And so I was doing television and then I didn't have any television. So I'm like, oh, I got to do commercials again. I really didn't want to do it. But I did it. I'm like, all right, I'm just going to do it. I had a kid, so I'm like, I'm just going to go and check my ego at the door. So I went out to Santa Monica, which is always a nightmare. And I got there. I'm sitting in line, and I'm trying to, like, just be in the moment. So I'm like, all right, I'm doing this. And then I walk in, and the first thing the person says is, okay, put the frog costume on. And that, to me, was like, I can't do commercials anymore.
You just left. You didn't put
on
the frog costume?
No, I did. I did, but I'm not, like, a snob, but I don't do well in commercials, and it's always something like that. It's always like, put the frog costume on or whatever.
So did you try to do the frog costume?
I didn't book it. I committed. No,
you
I
did.
Fully
you were
committed.
100%. I'm in.
Fully
Stanislavski,
committed.
Sense memory, what does a frog feel?
Yeah. And a lot of actors, like, you have to do commercials, and they're very lucrative, but it's also a number. You have to do like 100 to book two, and so it's very exhausting, especially in L.A. because you're driving, so it's sort of not ideal.
Did you see the movie La La Land?
Yes.
So the audition scenes, when you are pouring your heart out and your casting agent is on his or her phone or like reading email.
Food is a good sign that you're not going to get it when the food order comes in.
But that's not the exception. That's what it really looks like.
Yeah. Usually they try to be decent, but if it's a numbers thing, like a commercial audition where they're going to see 100 people who look like you and they're just cranking out 1 minute, you know, auditions, it's not like a rehearsed 2-page or 3-page scene for a drama or something. They're not as focused on you.
So we'll get to the parts that you got through a great audition. But since we're on this subject, the parts you didn't get, where you went in, you said, I am so right for this. This is the perfect part for me. I am prepared. I'm going to knock this out of the park. You walk out of it, go, nailed it. And then the phone never rings. Can you think of something that...
There was something... I think,
and maybe it turned out for the better. Maybe it was a bad project. But something you really wanted that you didn't
second,
land.
I think it's more like if... like second season of Veep was up and I was waiting and this casting woman came out and just basically was worshiping me and worshiping the show for like a half hour. And then you're sitting with a bunch of actors like, oh, great, this guy's going to freaking get it. So I was like, and I wasn't encouraging the conversation. She just kept going on and on. So we talked for like 15, 20 minutes. Then she brought me in and we talked another 15, 20 minutes. I'm like, wow, I don't see any. And of course, I didn't get it. So then I always feel like whenever somebody really talks to you a lot and tells you how much you love you, they love you, you never get those.
Bad sign. Bad like sign. If you're dating and somebody's like, you've got a great personality. I really like spending time with
this
you. The phone's
definitely
never going to
go somewhere. Yeah, that is. It's kind of true.
Wow.
It's absolutely true, yeah.
I want to hear a little bit about your training and how much of it was training you did on your own and how much of it was kind of through great teachers, because you started Upright Citizens Brigade mm-hmm. with some friends. Mm-hmm. And how much of that was to develop your own comedy and how much of it was to become kind of a place where people similar to you could come work?
I think I learned it on the job, like just doing sketches and improv made me a better actor, but I was probably bad for many, many years. And I did shows at a place called the Annoyance Theater and Improv Olympic, and we started UCB. So it took me many years to get good, but it was under my own control or my own auspices. We wrote the material, so there was sort of permission to fail. You weren't hired. And then I think the first real acting gig I got was a play called The Gathering, which was a comedic Last Supper. Which was
nothing sounds like good times
it was a big hit around Easter because it was a 13-person cast.
This is in Chicago?
This is in Chicago at a place called the Players Workshop. So you had 12 apostles and one Jesus. Jesus never spoke. And you had the families of 13 people coming to see that play. So it was kind of a built-in audience. And so, is that my phone?
It's
I'm
not
so sorry.
Mine.
That is so rude. Anyways.
I'm trying to be a good guest. Keep talking. Fill the air.
We typically say to people, be sure to turn off your phone, but I thought a professional actor like Matt Walsh would, since it's ringing now, on Veep, on stage, in the middle of a stand-up, as has happened before, or you try to interrupt yourself?
I always interpreted turn off your phone as leave it on buzz, but it's off.
And are you going to take the call? That would be the true test.
No, I would never.
Okay.
And it's only because my kids are with a babysitter. It's the only reason.
Okay. That's the excuse everybody uses, right?
It's real. It's real.
But it's actually legit. So you're talking about Jesus and the apostles.
So that was like the first. And then the other play I got was a play called What Cops Know, which was basically short excerpts of like real grisly stories by Chicago police. And that was the other like legit theater I ever booked. But everything else was just me bringing a bag of props with friends and doing shows. And I did stand up too. And then I took real acting. I took one acting class in college. And the story about that is, it was a super sweet man. He used to wear like, he looked like he came out of a Land's End catalog. He had a tied sweater and boat shoes, very tall, effeminate, but so just amazing teacher. At the end of the class, he's like, come to my office. I'll write a very long narrative about what you need to work on, what your gifts are, et cetera. So I was really excited to have somebody like open up my skills. And I got there and there was nothing on the wall. And I said, where's Dr. So-and-so? And he's like, oh, he's in jail. And what happened? And well, we'll talk about it. And then I found out later, he was like in a bail bonds scam. He was like getting bail bonds sent from inmates. And then he was laundering them on the, like giving them 50 cents on the dollar. But the sweetest,
bad
kindest,
idea.
Sweetest,
laundering money for people in jail?
Yeah. Sweetest, kindest man. Like you would never expect that guy to be involved in like that kind of a scam. So I never found out.
You never found out what your grade or your skills were?
Yes. And then, so I never took another acting class in college. And then after college, there's good theaters in Chicago. I took a class at Victory Gardens. And then I took one at, when I moved to New York, I took like a hardcore, like Ibsen or some class where you only do that, or Chekhov, where you only do Chekhov plays.
And that sounds fun.
That was pretty intense. And then I took one more out here in LA. So I've taken like five or six different teachers. And the one in L.A. was my friend Andrew's like, you want to take a class? And we took it. And the beginning of the class was always the teacher would say, okay, I want to walk you through a range of emotions, which is good. You know, like try to remember the happiest thing you are. Now really embody that so that you'd have like 16 adults like walking around. Ha ha. Now close your eyes. Now be that baby. Be that adolescent. Be that. Now go to a place where you're like serious and everybody's serious and the room be quiet. Now go to a place that's kind of sad or disappointing. And we did this warm-up every class, and there was a woman who relived something really horrible when we got to the sad thing. Like she was really loud and really screaming and going through something really painful, and it was uncomfortable to be in the room and have her walk through that every class. So I think I dropped out of that one halfway through.
For people who don't know, the practice and studying of acting, especially in school or in an acting class, can be bizarre.
Yeah.
You can see some weird stuff happening in terms of what the teachers are asking the students to do, what the students are doing. And if you think bad theater is bad, bad acting class is a league unto itself.
It's true, but you also don't want to be like a snob or be ironic or like, I'm too cool for this. If you're in the room, you better be committing to what they're asking you to do. So it's that battle of like keeping your intellect away or just committing to whatever they ask you to do. So it is a battle, but there are the bad acting class is a class where you go and the teacher just tells you, oh, you're amazing. You have that thing. I can't take my eyes off you. And then after 8 weeks, you leave and you're like, I don't think I learned anything, because there's no like tools or takeaway. They don't teach you how to break it down or how to research.
I spent a lot of money, but yeah. I don't have anything to show for it.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about stand-up and what it's like to succeed at stand-up, and equally important, what it's like to bomb, and what that teaches you, and how you walk away from that experience as a better performer and with a little more kind of moral stamina to stand up in front of an audience and believe in yourself.
Stand-up's the hardest of all the like art forms I've ever done. So it's really wonderful when you have like a bit or I mostly did characters. Like I would just cook up, like I'll be a clown who was in Vietnam, or I'll be like a, you know, a Rat Pack comedian and dress it up and have props and stuff. So I would always try bits like that. I didn't have like a Seinfeld keen observation type of act. But when you try something and it succeeds, there's nothing more exhilarating. But it's brutal if you get into like the first two supposed laughs and there's nothing and you're committed to like 8 minutes of this character. It's a nightmare. And you're also alone if you're on the road, which I did in the tri-state Illinois area, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, and you get off stage, the comics won't look at you, the guys you're traveling with, and then it's like you're in your hotel room reliving that. So it's a very punishing art form.
How do you stay with it? I mean, how do you know that even if you're having a bad night or a bad series of nights, if people aren't laughing at yourself, because it might be a persona, but it really is you naked on stage, that it is complete rejection of who you are as a person, as a performer.
It is.
There's no place to hide. How do you not say, fuck it, I can't do this anymore?
I only did it for a year and a half, so I did say fuck
That's
it. I did quit on it. I'm not that strong. But I think the people who stick with it are like, I think part of you likes the bomb of it. Like they enjoy, like they can step away and see like this, there's nothing, there's never been a comedian worse than me, and they can sort of laugh at themselves. So they have a way to detach themselves from that moment. They don't internalize it like this is all I got and they're rejecting me and I'm no one. They can walk away from it. And I also think like you really have to enjoy that obsessive sort of, you know, shifting indefinite articles and like building in pauses. And like it's an art form that you hone. And you really have to enjoy that process.
When you are doing improv with a troupe, with a group of people, I would imagine that when it's firing on all cylinders, when for whatever reason, people are coming up with lines or situations that are out of this world, that there's probably few better feelings as a performer.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's because you get to places you never could conceive of on your own. And it's also seamless, that it feels, you know, written or, you know, planned. And just the variety of scene work that you can stumble into is amazing. And for it to not seem to the audience like there was never a dull moment is pretty incredible. And also, like, there's the – when you do long forms, like a 30 to 40-minute set, and you start to connect things, bring things back, or call things back, and they sort of – storylines sort of fold in as if it's a true narrative. That's even more amazing.
I want to go back to, I think, what, 1998, when Upright Citizens Brigade was founded. Is that right?
We were kind of founded in 96 when we landed in New York. Like, we existed in Chicago in the early 90s in various iterations, but the four of us moved to New York in 96.
The four of you being?
Matt Besser, Amy Poehler, Ian Roberts, and myself.
What was the precipitating incident that formed it, and where were you professionally? How did it give you something to do, and how did it improve your ability to get work going forward?
Well, I think the idea to go to New York, we had been performing shows in Chicago. I think from like 94 on, it was the four of us. And then we would do these showcases. We always had ambition to get a sketch show. Like, we worshipped Kids in the Hall. Like, that was our, those guys were, all had a voice, and they weren't like a dream team like SNL puts you together. They were always together, and you could feel the tone of their sensibility. So that was our dream. And so we would have occasional, like, casting agents come through from LA. We lived in Chicago for a couple of years, or we'd have like somebody casting a sketch group or something, and they would come and see us for one day. But there was a manager who was working with us who basically said, if you really want to like get multiple people to see you who might give you a deal to write a pilot or make a show, you have to go to New York or LA. So we had like a sit down at the Salt and Pepper Diner, which was right next to this our home theater, Improv Olympic, and we just said, you know, we want to go LA or New York. And we decided New York because New York had a ongoing theater audience. The times we had been to LA was like you do a showcase and then you leave the theater and you go back home. But New York felt like we could build a following. So we moved to New York in 96 and we literally had a U-Haul with like three shows worth of props in it and wigs and drove through a snowstorm. And I drove out with Horatio Sands, who's a good friend of mine. And my car, I had a VW Vanagon and my car broke down in a snowstorm. It was hilariously like cliche.
That car is probably worth $80,000 now, right?
No.
It's a collector's
item. I stayed with Ian Roberts' parents when I landed in New Jersey, and I sold it, and that was like 3 months' rent.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was good.
At what point does what you're doing with Upright Citizens Brigade give you a part in theater, a part in film, something in television? Because as much as you're enjoying it, a lot of it is about career advancement, right?
Yeah, I think, like, we were doing the show called Luna Lounge in New York, which was, like, the heart of the alt-comedy scene. People like Marc Maron and Todd Barry and Jeanine Garofalo and Zach Galifianakis were all just running around New York at the time. So every Monday night, there was this free comedy show that all those people would pop up. So we had an in there, and we did well our first night, and we kept doing it every Monday night. And that show had a name for itself. This is just a microcosm of my world. And in that audience, inevitably, would be a guy who directs commercials, a casting woman for a TV show, somebody who's writing something. And then after that show, they would call your agent or they would talk to you after the show and say, I'm doing this thing, or do you want to be in a commercial? So it's just like being in a very visible show or a very visible location, and word of mouth sort of builds from that. And then once you're, say, on TV or in The Daily Show, then you have more visibility. People understand you're funny. But it's that's basically it. If you're in a show that people who have opportunities come and see, they sort of fall in love with you and give you a shot.
Would you say that there was one part that was your big break that really kind of changed your prospects, that made work not quite as elusive?
I think being on The Daily Show. I remember being on The Daily Show the first time I did it, and John's at the desk and goes, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Walsh. And it was like the first time, like UCB was UCB, and it was the four of us, and we were nameless, you know, Uber organization that pulled strings on the universe. So it was never like you alone. And so when I did The Daily Show, I just remember that first time, ladies and gentlemen, Matt Walsh, and there's applause, and it's like, oh, I'm my own thing. And that stuck with me. It's like, oh, that's, you're separate now. You're your own person.
One of the things that you are fortunate to have is a recurring part on Veep, but it wasn't your first recurring part. You've had a couple before that. Yes?
I have. I was on a show called, what the heck was it?
It's really good. It's a good one, I guess.
Outsourced. It was funny. It was a great print. It was based on a movie where this American company they made novelty items like a fly in an ice cube or fake vomit, and they outsourced production to India. So they sent a couple of Americans to supervise the manufacturing, and it was a good movie. And then they made it a TV show, and so it was all these like Indian comedians who lived here in LA. And a couple of white people, quite simply.
Sounds like a good premise.
Dietrich Bader, who was on Veep now, was on it. But it was a funny premise, but it didn't last.
Veep is now in its, what, sixth season?
Yes.
Just started.
Yeah, last Sunday.
Unbelievable. And your character is no longer in the White House. Mm-mm. I want to ask a little bit about a series like that and how it grows. And it clearly has a point of view. And it also has a lot of very talented comedians and actors working on it. So when you're on a series that has a clear point of view from its showrunner and also is part of an ensemble where there are a lot of people who have good ideas, How do you strike a balance between what the showrunners want the show to be and what the actors can bring to the performance? What does the give and take look like?
Well, the big strokes always come from the writers. Like, the head writer runs the writer's room, and they map out the season, and they create the series arc, and they finalize the scripts, and they edit. So they it all comes from them, generally. But they, because the American writers who came in season 5 inherited a show that was up and running, and the characters were succeeding, and they also inherited a process that was very collaborative, they sort of respected it. And the way our process is, you table read a script, scenes that aren't working, you put them on their feet, you improvise around those scenes, the writers take notes, and every season they sit you down and you pitch them ideas for your character, and they may use none of them, they may use some of them, or they may mutate them into something that ends up being a storyline. And then on the day when the script is finalized, you pitch ideas about various jokes, or you ask for more jokes. So it's a give and take, but I think the writers, you know, sort of dictate the meat and potatoes of what's going to happen.
It would be very easy to look at a series like Veep right now and say art is imitating life or life is imitating art. When you guys are in the process of working on this show and you see what's happening in the election, well, I guess the question is, what was happening in the election as you were working on the show? What was the overlap between writing, producing, and the election of Donald Trump?
Trump was, I think when they got into the writer's room for season 6, I don't think Trump looked like he was going to be the Republican nominee, but he hadn't locked it up. So also they inherited the storyline from season 5, which was she's no longer president. So they mapped out stuff around Selena's world and stuff that the intention was right after season 5 is to explore what all these guys are doing, like Carter and Clinton and both Bushes, how they exist in the world, how they try to stay relevant, the foundations they build, the state funerals they go to. And that was really interesting to them. And then when Trump got elected, we were already up and running. And I think they had a crisis of faith because it did change a lot for standard political satire. But ultimately, they didn't change anything, really. They might have rejiggered some jokes, but the storylines were all in place.
Does it change the nature of what it feels like to be on the show? That what might have been satirical and broad is maybe a little bit closer to truth than it was maybe a year ago?
I think this year, no. Like, we are coming back next year. Who knows what's going to happen? But this year felt like we were operating in our world, and it was sort of focused on Selena's ego and each character's ego and, you know, ambition. So it didn't – I mean, we were filming the day the election results came in, and it was like a slowly – gloomier and gloomier room, and we were sort of stumbling.
You were working that night.
We were filming a scene that was about an election, actually. We were monitoring election in a foreign country as part of Selena's post-presidency responsibilities, and so there were polling stations, and it was very weird. And I'm sure the footage from that scene wasn't really great because there wasn't a lot of range of emotion coming out of the actors. But we got through it, and it was only one tiny piece of an entire season, so... But I don't think, I mean, it's more the writers who probably have to, like, deal with, like, what's going to be surprising or what's going to be true now. But as the actors, you're still playing a character that's been up for 6 years in a fictional reality.
If you are a guest actor who is walking into Veep, it's got to be a little bit difficult because the language is incredibly brutal. The cutdowns are unspeakably harsh. Do guest actors get prepared to what is going to happen to them? And what is that experience like for people who are maybe uninitiated?
Well, people are genuinely nice on the show. So when somebody comes in, everyone's like, oh, you're so funny and great to see you. But there are, like, people who sit down and they'll sit across from you. And if it's an obese actor, the lines are like, okay, fatso, why are you so fat? Like, I've said this before, like, whatever... You can't have any sense of vanity because, you know, if you have a lazy eye or if you're too skinny or if you have a weird mustache, the writers will write it into the script. Like, you can't hide. I've been made fun of millions of times. Jonah, obviously, like, they pick you apart for comedy fodder. So people who are in there for one day, it is hard because you want to make sure that they come out of that experience knowing that you're a nice person and that everybody gets beat up like that.
Interesting idea. People who know about what reality looks like inside the White House have singled out this show for being unbelievably accurate among all the shows that are about politics. They say that Veep has really got it right. Does that mean something to you that you're getting, even in a broad comedy, that the truths that you're talking about, the way in which an administration talks, is pretty much spot on?
Yeah, I do feel like we're peeking behind the curtain, which I love, and I love that people in politics give us credit for that, because we do a lot of research with various political people every season, try to get people on both sides of the aisle, people who work for them. And, I mean, it's a little disappointing because we're such a bunch of buffoons to find out that we're accurately portraying what happens out there. You would hope it's because it's such serious business. But at the same time, as an actor or as someone who, you know, creates a show with everybody else, I do take pride in that when people say your show nails it. I'm very happy because a lot of effort goes into that.
If we were to do a scorecard, Mike McClintock versus Sean Spicer.
This is the question everyone's asking. But maybe not.
Just a scorecard.
Okay.
Ability to wing it. Who wins?
They're both pretty bad, but Mike... So they're both terrible. Like, they both get 1 out of 10. But Mike has been beaten up enough to know to shut his mouth. I don't think Spicer does that enough.
Able to sell a story even if people aren't buying it.
Who's better? Oh, I think Mike's better at that. I think Mike's better. And Mike, I think, doesn't necessarily have a better sense of humor, but he thinks he has a better sense of humor. And I think that helps him survive and sort of ease tense moments.
Actually understanding what it is that he's talking about.
Oh, maybe Sean Spicer. Maybe Sean Spicer's a little smarter than Mike McClintock. Maybe.
And what could Sean Spicer learn from Mike McClintock?
What could he learn from Mike McClintock? That is a very good question. I don't know. What could he learn? I guess I think I've sort of repeated that, but it's more about just cling to the talking points, shut your mouth, don't create a bigger fire than you went out there to put out. Like, I think Mike's okay at that. He's not great. He does create problems, but not as often as Spicer.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's ever used the word or the phrase Holocaust Center.
No.
One of the advantages of a show as successful as Veep is you have a gig and it doesn't last all year and you get paid for it, and that gives you the ability to do things on hiatus. I want to talk about a couple of things you've been doing. Brigsby Bear, which was at Sundance this past January, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I guess the less we say about this, the better, because to explain it is to start to give some things away. But when you're looking at a movie like Brigsby Bear, how do you come into a movie like that? And what are the things that are important to you as an actor that you don't get to do ordinarily that makes a project like that attractive?
Well, Brigsby Bear was an amazing script. It was so well written. It was one of those scripts that you read like, oh, I haven't read anything like this in a long time. So that's what made me interested in it. And then when they offer you a part, you're like, oh, well, then definitely I'm interested. When you don't have to audition, you're more interested. And I knew Kyle Mooney, who was at the center of it, and Dave, and they were kind of a sketch group at UCB for a while, so I sort of knew them, and Michaela Watkins was doing it. So it's about who's doing it that makes it interesting to you. And I think it's ultimately, the script is so interesting, and the things I can tell you is he's a kid who's taken from a hospital when he's, you know, just born, and then he's kept in seclusion by a family, and then when he's 25 or 26, the cops find him and return him to his real parents, which are played by me and Michaela. And that sort of tension was really interesting to me, to be around someone that you thought was gone, and now they're back in your life. And also there was like weird comedic moments in what is really a heavy, heavy subject.
Yeah, it's about an abduction.
Yeah, it's about an abduction, and it's about returning to a kid who's not normal. Like, he grew up in a very bizarre household, and he's definitely not normal, and you think he's going to be like you, and he's nothing like you, and then you're trying to do normal things, or trying to create a relationship, and it's not easy. But also some really funny moments happen in the film. That's what made it interesting, so I was excited to do that.
And you also have Life of the Party with Melissa McCarthy, or as
yes.
We should call her, Sean Spicer.
She does a great Sean Spicer.
She does a great. She has a better Sean Spicer
yes,
than
I
Sean
play
Spicer.
I play a jerk husband, and Melissa and I had worked together in Ghostbusters, and I know her from around town, and she just called me and said, hey, how would you like to play my jerk husband? And I said, sure. So that was easy.
So having been in Ghostbusters, but as a guy, and to see the savaging that that movie got because it was about women reinventing parts played by men, what does it feel like to think about how far we have come and how far we have not come when that kind of movie is subjected to the kind of hatred that it was subjected to?
I was surprised, honestly, because I assumed that, like, internet nerds would be more progressive in their view of the world, and a lot of the hatred came from these, like, internet nerds, which was, I was very surprised. And then I also was like, it's kind of a false premise to think that we get to say who gets to be a star. Like, if you see a movie and you're like, that guy's not funny, oh my God, he gets to do another movie, it's like, you never get to vote on that. Do you know what I mean? Like, so to say they're upset that Paramount or whoever let these characters be portrayed by someone they don't like, and these people felt like they own it. Like, we love those movies. Like, Ghostbusters did, people are very bonded to that film. It was like a rite of passage for, like, people who were in their adolescence or 20s when they saw that. But at the end of the day, we never get to say, when you see a movie poster, and it's like, oh my God, that guy, really? He gets to do another movie? You don't get to say. You never get to say. So that was the other part of it. It's like, guys, we don't get to greenlight who gets to be in those movies. So you got to let go. We never get to.
Yeah, they don't get that, do they?
No. That's sort of the thing that, like, that's the ultimate truth of it. It's like, I understand you're attached to a movie, and it did mean a lot, and I love that movie. But at the end of the day, it's like, well, Universal or Warner Brothers can do whatever they want, right? I mean, don't you know that?
When you play a character as well-known and maybe potentially as polarizing as Mike McClintock, are there people you see in the real world who conflate actor for character and will tell you how you should be doing your job?
Well, I do get people who want to, like, get into, like, teasing me a little bit or something, like, oh, you poor sap. And that is, like, identifying me as that character, and I don't linger around those moments too long. And then the thing that would be challenging is if, like, I was the doctor in The Hangover and people always want me to say this one line, go get a map and F yourself or whatever. And I never say that, but they always come up to me and say, hey, can you say your line? I'm like, no, I can't.
I guess the worst scenario, like, if they don't ask you anything, though.
No, it's great. But I don't get mad about it. I'm just matter of fact about it. I'm like, how dare you? I'm just like, no, I can't. I'm not going to. And they're like, really? I'm like, no, but I'll take a picture. I'll sign something, but I don't want to say the line.
So looking at your career in stand-up, in live theater, in improv.
Every medium, really.
Every medium. We should talk about your Chicago Bears podcast, right?
UCB Sports and Leisure. Yeah, let's plug everything. It used to be called Bear Down Podcast, and it was me and Scott Armstrong and a bunch of Chicago guys stuck in L.A., started a podcast about the Bears. And then it basically turned into sports parody. We would get people who could impersonate Tiger Woods or Ozzie Guillen or anybody.
What does a Tiger Woods impersonation sound like?
You just talk about hooking up with waitresses.
That's what I think, so.
Yeah, you get it. that was a good
one. You want to see my putter?
Yeah, exactly.
Four strokes under par.
Yes. And so that show has since turned into UCB Sports and Leisure, and we treat it like almost like Brian Gumbel Real Sports, where we do these segments where we explore the world of sports. And then Leisure covers anything.
Right.
Leisure can be politics, can be food, can be
booze.
So, yeah, anything.
But does all of that add up to something where there is something that you can do that is going to be funny or different from what you did previously? Is it important, in other words, to have the buffet of options as an actor that you can go from one to another depending on what mood you're in and what you need, what part of your back you need scratched?
Do you mean like creating a construct called Sports and Leisure?
No,
do you mean
just anything, having those options, UCB, being able to do.
Yeah, it really is. It's a lazy man's dream to have a podcast studio like in the theater, so I can just go in and do a podcast for an hour and then leave, and to have a up and running improv show that I can pop in and do things like that. And it is like completely whatever's easiest is what I tend to do.
So you actually are lazy.
Well, I'm not lazy, really, but I tend to like low-maintenance options. I like things that don't have because if you had a – you're in the world of radio and podcasting. If you had a podcast where you had to show up and they were counting on you, like UCB Sports and Leisure will go down for a month because I'm not around. I'm just not in the mood. No one to answer to. Same thing with like ASCAT. I don't have to be there. There's no one to answer to. So I like those scenarios where I create it, where I can do it if I want to, and I don't have to if I don't want to.
And are you going to direct another movie?
I will. My wife and I are trying to crack on a story that we will probably finish in a year. So yes, I will.
And I hope it will be funny.
I think it will. I think it will. Yeah, it will be funny.
Funnier than your Tom Berenger monologue?
Well, at the Chekhov thing, I did another comedic monologue that I wrote, and the guy said the same thing. He says, "Do you have anything comedic?" And I was like, "Really?
Wait, what monologue from Chekhov is comedic?"
No. Okay. For the Chekhov school.
Okay.
You had to come in with a comedic monologue and a dramatic monologue. So I did my homemade comedic monologue for this head of the program, and then I did it, and no laughs. And then he's like, "Okay, well, how about this? Do you have anything comedic?" And I was like, "Oh my!" I didn't even say anything. I said, "No, I don't have anything comedic."
Matt Walsh, thanks for coming on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thanks. When am I going to see you again?
I don't know. Maybe
Let's
next
do a
week.
Podcast somewhere. I know. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Download new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.
Everyone sells today, so how do you bring your best sales game every day? Simple. Listen to the Advanced Selling Podcast on Podcast One. Hi, I'm Bill Caskey.
And I'm Brian Neal. Each week, we answer listener questions like, how do I compete against a cheap competitor?
And Brian's favorite, because he always has an answer to this, how do I meet with a CEO when they won't even return my calls?
The Advanced Selling Podcast is where the best go to get better. Listen Mondays on Podcast One and on iTunes.